playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands. Playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the Irish Times Weekend Edition. Your weekend's in good hands with our sumptuous food features, intrepid travel stories and engrossing sports coverage.
Good morning. Communication problems were at the heart of the cervical check controversy, and the scoping inquiry by Dr. Gabriel Scally was set up to examine the non-disclosure of information to Vicky Phelan in the wake of her successful High Court action. On Tuesday, she and over 200 women affected felt they'd been let down again when segments of the report were leaked to the media before they'd had a chance to see it. Vicky Phelan gave her reaction on The Ray D'Arcy Show.
I woke up yesterday morning. I decided to have a lie-in because I was wrecked, to be honest, and trying to get ready for the week ahead. Because we have a busy week. We have a big day coming up on Sunday with the launch of the support group. So I needed to kind of rest. I woke up at 10:15. Of course, first person I know I got a message from was, "Don't call anybody else before you call me," from Stephen. So I knew something was up. There was about 50 missed calls. I don't know how many messages. And I actually was nearly afraid to see what was out. I knew it. I knew in my heart and soul it was a leak. I knew it. And started looking at Facebook and Twitter. I was just so, you could have just knocked me with a feather. I was so upset. I just thought, here we go again. You know, we're the last ones to know. This is exactly the same thing. And it's just compounding the hurt and the pain felt by everybody.
A 5.5 hour briefing session with Dr. Scally was arranged for three of the campaigners, and then at lunchtime on Wednesday, the 170-page Scally report was finally published. Dr. Scally had drilled down into 12,000 documents, conducted hundreds of interviews, and visited the test laboratories involved. He found that the cervical cancer screening programme was doomed to fail. He found serious gaps in the governance and oversight of the programme, that there was no accountability, no single senior person was in charge of the shop for the past 8 years. His report also exposed a paternalistic culture within our health system, bordering on misogyny, and he criticised the attitude of some consultants towards their cancer patients.
Referring to one of these open disclosure meetings, a woman said, "When I tried to question my oncologist further on what this meant and if I had cancer 3.5 years prior to diagnosis, he shut down, refused to answer the simplest of questions and ushered me out of the door with no support and many questions." Women frequently asked their clinicians that they saw in these open disclosure meetings why they hadn't been told. Some of the answers they were given: he said he didn't know the protocol. He said it got lost in the file. He said it was caveated not to disclose, told more or less to file it. He sat back in his chair, couldn't give two hoots, was his attitude. Asked by a woman, "Why didn't you tell me? Why didn't you tell my clinicians?" Answer, "What difference does it make?" Asked again, "But how will I be informed from now on?" Answer, "Watch the news." He said he had seen I had had the hysterectomy and decided I didn't need to know. He basically lied to me. I don't believe a word that they are saying. He couldn't look me in the eye.
There's an account in here of one episode. I have difficulty speaking about this one. One episode, and it was of a deceased woman. I spoke to the members of her family at their request, and I met with them. And they told me, they said they went in for their disclosure meeting, and the consultant said several times about the late woman's smoking habit and also told them that nuns don't get cervical cancer. Now, if that isn't paternalism, it's verging on misogyny, isn't it? Yeah? If that isn't paternalism, what is it?
While campaigners affected by the controversy say that they don't want heads to roll, they insist all of Dr. Scally's 50 recommendations must be implemented. Ray D'Arcy spoke with Stephen Teep, whose wife Irene died last year, with Lorraine Walsh, one of the 221 women affected by the scandal, and Vicky Phelan, the woman who exposed the whole sorry mess.
One thing that I liked about Gabriel from the get-go was that he has a very sense of social justice, and fairness, and he saw clearly straight away that women had been very badly treated, and that was the thread throughout the whole report, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, and a culture of paternalism, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Would you be confident that all the recommendations will be put into place?
I don't know. I would hope so. I mean,
I believe you spoke to Róisín Molloy.
I did, and that's where my scepticism comes from, because you know Róisín Molloy, who is Mark Molloy's mother, she was herself and Mark, her husband, brought the Portlaoise baby death scandal, and none of the recommendations from that have been implemented, and that was 3 years ago now, isn't it? You know, so that was one thing she did warn me about, you know, and she didn't do it to be negative. She did it to make me be realistic, and I suppose to realise that these things take time. But I suppose the advantage that we have here is that Lorraine and Stephen are already on a committee. Like, one of Gabriel's suggestions for getting these recommendations implemented was to establish a committee, but there is already one existing.
A steering committee,
because what he wanted on this committee was a representative from each of the state bodies, which already exists in the steering committee. So I can't see why they can't start this work straight away.
And Lorraine, overall, what was your reaction to the report?
I was astonished at the level of detail in the report, to be honest. I didn't expect a fifth of the detail. You'll see there it's a 200-page document, and he has uncovered a lot of information, a lot of emotional information, a lot of stuff that we, you know, didn't expect to hear. But at the same time, it has given us some answers. I think clearly as well, it has brought up more questions that he's going to have to delve further into, you know, and find out the answers to. But certainly overall, there's a lot of information in it. And as I said there, you know, we spent 5.5 hours with the man that actually wrote it yesterday evening, and we're still trying to digest the information. It's huge. It's so complex. So there's a lot of answers in
it. Stephen, what was your reaction?
I suppose it was hard to know what we were going to be met with this inquiry. And, you know, I was kind of thinking, right, is this just going to be a book of problems, you know? And it's going to list all of the problems. But what I was most surprised with was that nearly every problem that was identified, there was a solution highlighted for it. And what we see here is 50 recommendations. And what these 50 recommendations do, once implemented, they improve the screening programme today. You know, like, if they were have all those implemented by 6 o'clock today, the screening programme will be a better thing. And that's, you know, reason why do we, why are we putting so much effort into all of this, is to improve the screening program, right? So it was great to see that. I was actually delighted to see those. So it's just trying to get the commitment to have all of those recommendations put in place, because that's what's going to improve this too.
From the Ray Darcy Show. Well, Dr. Peter Boylan is the chair of the Institute of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. He says his institute supports the policy of open disclosure. He spoke with Mary Wilson on Drive Time.
Peter Boylan, can I ask you maybe for your thoughts and a response to that question posed in Gabriel Scally's report? Why does it always happen to women? Is it a fair question?
It's a very fair question, and he's right. There have been too many instances in the Irish health system where women have been way down the list of priorities. And I think one of the ways that we can deal with this is to ring-fence women's healthcare budget and keep it separate from general hospital budgets, because that's one of the problems around the country. One of the first things to get cut when there's a shortage of cash is women's healthcare. And we also need to develop a system whereby women's needs are at the heart of services, as somebody has said. And we also need to listen to women. There was a National Women's Council established many years ago, I think in the late 80s or 90s, but then that disappeared when it was absorbed into the Department of Health. So we need to concentrate, and the way that there was a separate budget, for example, for cancer services, and we need to do the same thing with women's healthcare, particularly in the areas of gynaecology and obstetrics.
It's a very lengthy report, but your first reactions to those main findings, you know, about the lack of governance and oversight of the cervical screening programme. Is that a surprise to you?
No, not at all. I think the Institute will welcome all of the recommendations in the Scally report. The role of the Institute is training of doctors and advocacy on behalf of women's healthcare. I think one of the things that needs to happen, and which is going to happen apparently, is that the HSE will get a board to which they will report. The governance of the cervical check programme clearly needs to be reorganised, and it needs more investment. The clinical director, for example, was only on a part-time, 2 days a week basis in Dublin, and the administration office is down in Limerick. There's no one person responsible for the whole cervical check programme. So there's a whole series of problems. I think also the open disclosure needs to be legislated for. And if ever there was an example of the consequences of non-disclosure, it is the whole cervical check mess, really, that we're in at the moment. It all stems from not telling women and not including them in their care, and basically not treating them as partners in their care.
Dr. Peter Boylan with Mary Wilson, heard on Wednesday's Drive Time. Well, the fallout from the Scally report was also discussed on the gathering yesterday by politicians Louise O'Reilly of Sinn Féin and Fine Gael's Noel Rock, and by journalists Alison O'Connor and Lise Hand.
You know, the language that was used in this report was incredible. You know, it was very strong. I mean, there were words like inappropriate, hurtful, offensive, heartlessness, hauteur, arrogance, condescension, insensitivity, paternalism.
And he did draw a connection between that kind of language and ill treatment and the way it seems to be a male-dominated profession.
Absolutely.
Alison, 50 recommendations, are they all implementable? Because the government says they all will be implemented.
Yeah, I mean, I think to continue what Lise is saying, it just struck me that the Dr. Scally's report is so un-Irish. There's no obfuscation. And in such an incredible short space of time, it shows what can be done. I mean, it shows up very starkly reports that went before it and sets a standard for those that will come after it. And I think if you even look at the difference in tone between that and something like the Harding-Clark report into some physiotomy or even the McAleese report into the Magdalens. So, I mean, I would back everything that Louise and Lise have said in terms of the paternalism, the treatment, all of that. But I was very struck after reading the report by the fact that it seems, given the absolute disarray that went on in the organisation, the governance, the key positions not being filled, all of that within cervical check, it's bordering on miraculous that we do apparently seem to have a testing system that is on a par with other countries. How that happened,
even though
you're left wondering.
There hadn't been laboratory visits for several years.
And I think that I would broaden that out. I mean, I think there's a real rottenness there. Broaden that out to the rest of the health system and you have to start thinking, you know, was cervical check an outlier? I suspect not. No. You know, and one final point. He went off course, if you like, Dr. Scally, by saying there shouldn't be a commission of inquiry. I happen to agree with him on that. But it was interesting where I thought one other area he could have was he could have addressed the political handling of this, both governmental and opposition. I think there was an extraordinary amount of scaremongering. Mm. And I would also include some of the media coverage has been appalling over the last number of months. And in terms of ambulance chasing by members of the legal profession, all combined to create an extraordinary level of hysteria.
Alison O'Connor. Well, the housing crisis was also discussed by Sean O'Rourke's panel. The launch of the government's land development agency, the plan to build 150,000 new homes over the next 20 years.
I've thought it interesting, right? We had the leak of the report, then we had the report, and then obviously the strategic decision was made, enough of them cervixes now, let's launch the housing.
Think like that,
let's
they?
Launch the housing agency, the bells and whistles, which we had yesterday morning. When I heard the Taoiseach's hyperbole on this is going to be like the ESB, my response was, listen, when you're out of short pants on the housing issue, you know, come back to us on how amazing you think it is.
Not only waiting for the long pants or the short pants or whatever to be grown out of. The ink is barely dry on that announcement. Mm. And yet today I'm looking at a big splash in the Irish Times insofar as they do splashes. Sports halls at centre of 12 billion plan for school investment.
Is there an election?
Well, you took the question out of my mouth. So,
well, I've had that feeling in my waters for months. I think you have the complications of Brexit and all sorts of other things going on. But I think purely from the point of view of the Taoiseach and himself and getting a mandate, I think it's a good time.
Well, there is
him.
A touch of the shock and awe about it, you know, roll out a whole pile of announcements on the back of a report that you dodge a bullet just as the doll is due back. A slight smell of the modus operandum of Leo Varadkar during the leadership
contest. But I mean, a lot of this is to do with the Project Ireland 2040 plan that was launched a number of months ago. And we did say we'd flesh out each aspect of that in detail. Over the summer, we fleshed out the cultural aspect of it. We had a big announcement for that. It was always the intention to have a housing announcement at this time of the year. And it was always the intention to have the education announcement. There'd be further ones to follow. I mean, it's just a natural
all in
part
one
of
week, though. It's, you know, it's a bit like buses. You hang around for ages and then three and they all the quality ones come together.
From Today with Sean O'Rourke yesterday. I was blown away by Ryan Tuberty's interview with South Pole explorer Mark Pollock and his fiancée, human rights lawyer and activist Simone George. They were in studio to talk about their TED Talk, which is all about hope and acceptance and their ambitious campaign to cure paralysis. But before all that, Ryan asked them about their very first meeting.
Actually, the first time I met Mark, I didn't speak to him. It was in, do you remember Nude, the cafe on Suffolk Street?
Yeah.
I was standing in the queue there and there was this tall, bald man with a beautiful guide dog in front of me. And he dropped some change on the floor and then didn't bend down to pick it up. And I thought, I have a friend who's really, really tall who used to say it wasn't worth, you know, the head rush of bending down for 5p. And so I bent down to pick up the money for him. And Larry, who was an excellent guide dog, but it turned out eventually adored me, licked my hand as I was picking up.
That was the dog,
coins.
Not me.
Yeah, as I was picking up the coins. And I handed them to him. And I remembered a solicitor I worked with had a friend he rode with who was blind and was Mark.
Yes.
And I remember thinking, I wonder if that's him. And then we met.
Wait. So you handed the change over.
Yeah, and said nothing.
Nothing?
No.
Not sort of, are you the guy with the wrong, nothing?
Well, that's kind of rude. Are you the blind guy who rose or just another blind guy?
Well, you strike me as somebody who doesn't waste time getting into the niceties and gets stuck into business. So I would have actually thought you might have said something.
But now bear in mind, Ryan, when we met, she met a blind guy with a guide dog. I wasn't sort of a South Pole adventurer guy. I was blind guy with a guide dog. And I met this kind of tour de force, legal, who was telling me all about her grandmother and her great-grandmother being born in an oasis in the Niger and her sort of multicoloured African, Middle Eastern background. You know, she was significantly more interesting than blind guy going to do the odd adventure
race. I think there's a pair of you in it, actually, to be fair.
About a year after getting back from the South Pole and 4 weeks before they were due to get married, Mark had an accident.
Well, I was over in England and I was at a rowing regatta, Henley Royal Regatta. And the second night I was there, I fell from a second story window onto the concrete below and fractured my skull. I had bleeds in my brain, huge internal injuries, and I couldn't feel or move anything from my stomach down. And all of that was added to the blindness. And, you know, I don't know how it happened. Nobody else knows either, but as a blind person I used to use my hand to feel my way, probably go into the bathroom, and that particular night my hand found an open space where the closed window should have been and I cartwheeled out, and that left me in intensive care and saw Simon coming across to England, staying for a year, and together we started this exploration into this unknown world of paralysis, and we did that together.
And Simon's research sparked a collaboration between scientists and robotics engineers working together to try to cure paralysis.
I said early on in the talk that around that moment in intensive care where Mark said to me, you need to get as far away from this as possible. When I decided to stay, I got all the way in. And it felt like literally a raging river that was sweeping Mark along. And the only way for me to rescue him was to get in to it with him. And to get into the grief of that. And we cried every day. I mean, Mark cried every day. There was this string of rowers that came into intensive care, devastated by what was happening to him. And I'll never forget seeing him hold hands with each of them, all these beautiful, strong, tall men crying together. And that really saved us. The embracing the grief of it really saved our mental health. And acceptance is, you have to get into grief. That grief as a river is a really common psychotherapy, psychology analogy.
In all the years I've met both of you and either of you, I don't think I've ever seen you so relaxed and happy. There's something about the two of you, but you just seem to be good.
If we go back to that time in hospital whenever this thing happened, we came crashing together in some kind of strange carer patient role. And certainly I found a direction, I found a way to live, and that's me exploring the intersection where humans and technology collide, and it's really interesting and exciting. And Simon's world, her human rights work across many different sectors, I think we have found our ways to live in both together and in our own right. And I think there's a certain satisfaction in that. And the book that we reference in the talk is Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. And I think we're starting to get to that place.
I mean, it's a really simple thing. But Mark, before he was paralysed, said to me, you have to fill your life with great things so there isn't room for the bad stuff. And that's what we're trying to do.
Simon George and Mark Pollock with Ryan Tuberty on Tuesday. On the face of things, Marianne Power was living the dream. She did an interesting job as a freelance journalist in London, a wide circle of friends. But underneath it all, she said she felt lost. So one day, while recovering from a particularly vicious hangover, she decided that she would road test 12 self-help books, one each month for a year, to try to improve herself and, of course, change her life. So she devoured everything from Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway to The Secret by Rhonda Byrne, one of the best-selling self-help books of all time.
Some people swear by it.
I know.
I find it completely preposterous. But yeah, The Secret.
Yeah.
Remind us of what The Secret's philosophy is.
So The Secret says you can have anything you want in life if you just believe. So it's down to something called the law of attraction. And Rhonda Byrne, the author, says there's lots of slogans. So thoughts become things. Yeah. And what you think about, you bring about. And I think it came out about 12 years ago and it's still often in the top 10. Like people, and the reason I read it before and I hated it, but the reason I did it was whenever I told people about the project, they'd either look at me like I was insane or they'd say, have you read The Secret? And then tell me, you know, I got my flat because of The Secret. I got my husband because of The Secret. So people swear by it.
Yeah. The chances are you got your husband because he fancied you and you fancied him.
And you decided you were ready for it.
And you decided. Yeah. But if you want to attribute it to Rhonda and her bank account, good luck, Rhonda. Isn't that it? Come on.
Yeah.
Did you try? How do you road test The Secret? Like, seriously.
So, so one of the things is that you download a blank check from The Secret website.
No.
You print off this check, payable by the universe is what's written on this check, and you fill it out for the amount you want. Yeah. And then you stick it on a pin board and you look at it every day and you believe that that money is going to come to you.
Well, so it worked for Rhonda.
Oh, it definitely worked for Rhonda. And I had a crisis about this because I didn't know how much to ask for. I didn't want the universe to think I was greedy.
So what did you ask
for? I asked for £100,000, which felt so bold and felt insane when I did it. You know, you're kind of thinking, am I losing my marbles here? I'm actually writing out a cheque to myself for
£100,000. And you pinned it up.
And I pinned it up on a vision board, which is another thing, a cork board where you're supposed to put pictures of everything you want in your life.
And how's your bank account?
Is it 100,000? Actually, it's better than it has been. In fairness.
You see, you're so cynical. It worked. What about the Mercedes?
Yes, Rhonda says if you've got a dream car, obviously visualise your dream car, put a picture up on a vision board, but to really, really get the impact, go and road test it. So I went to a Mercedes showroom and I sat behind this beautiful old Mercedes sports car and put my hands on the wheel. And
did it feel good?
Yeah, it felt great. And then I got the bus home.
Of course, the font of all knowledge is the Irish mammy. So not surprisingly, Marianne's own mother, Mary Power, who's originally from Ballybunion, features heavily in the book.
Your daughter turned around to you and said, I'm writing a book. And your reaction to me was priceless. Can you explain to us what you said to her?
What did I say to you?
You said a few things.
I forgot what I said to you. She used to remind me.
It was something about the journey.
Oh, so Mum, yeah, you're not a fan of the word journey.
That was when she'd been talking about this book and she was going to do this and you accepted, well, this is actually going to happen. And I must have been thinking about it and I just have an aversion to people using the word journey in relation.
Do you know how much I love you? Can I profess my love for you? Keep talking.
No, thank you. I love being told I'm loved.
Oh, yeah.
But anytime.
Keep talking, Mary. Keep talking. I'm loving this.
Yes. And I said to her, you know, please tell me you're not going to use the word journey. And she said no. And I thought that was good. And then she said,
I prefer the term spiritual path.
That's worse. Okay, what's your problem with the word journey for people's journey in life?
It just irritates me.
Why?
Yeah. People are doing, probably not leaving their kitchen, but they're talking about going on a journey just because they have done something or did something different, or I don't know what it is, but something really trivial, totally unimportant.
It happens all the time.
And they've done, you know, on this journey. Yeah. Where are you going? What's happening? What are you talking about?
Journey is Ballybunion to Dublin by bus. That's your journey.
It is.
That's how you got here.
It is.
Correct?
On a plane to Dublin Airport.
Yeah.
You're taking a journey.
Your life up
it's
to date.
It's not deep and meaningful.
No, it's on a plane or train or your life up until this point has been your life,
exactly.
Not your journey.
Exactly.
From the Ryan Tubridy Show on Thursday, and Marianne Power's book, published by Picador, is called Help Me. Jerry Mooney is an award-winning photographer with the Irish Independent, and he got a phone call from Kensington Palace, no less, to say that his photo of Duchess Meghan Markle greeting her fans at Trinity College last July had been chosen by Meghan for the cover of her birthday thank you cards.
Congratulations, Jerry.
Thank you, Ray. Thanks. It's a bit of a strange day. It's kind of gone viral, as they say.
You're gone viral.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I'm looking at the picture now. Will you describe it to people and then we'll find out how it came about?
Well, it's a picture of Meghan Markle in Trinity College after she had visited the Book of Kells. And it's a very warm, engaging picture. It's of her with people from Dublin, obviously, and she's after being given a bunch of flowers. And there's a great sense of enjoyment and sense of occasion with the picture. And like everybody is just kind of engaging with each other. There's no direct line of communication in the picture, but it's just a very warm picture. Yeah. And, you know, you can't help but kind of connect with the picture when you see it.
She has a big natural smile on her face, and so too do the four women who look to be talking to her. And she's centre stage. Harry's behind her. He's sort of out of focus.
Well, Jackie O'Halloran was listening to The Ray D'Arcy Show. She's one of the women featured in Gerry Mooney's photo.
I'm a big Royals fan and I went in the back gate of Trinity but didn't see any queue or anything and then walked through Trinity and then I saw the security barrier place. So I walked up to it and there was these two girls here to see Meghan and Harry.
Yeah.
So I said, oh, sure, I'll queue up with you. So, but what I hadn't realised was that there was a queue on Dawson Street, and that's where most of the people were coming in.
Okay.
They'd been on the train from Belfast at 4:45 that morning or something, and I was saying, and how did you know they were going to be here? And they said, oh, we rang Buckingham Palace, and they tell us what time, so they did. We were waiting, and then this guard came along and said, you know, you're not going to see them here, you'd be better off over the other side. So the girls were so disappointed. So I said, no, sure, we'll hold our ground and we'll see what happens. And then, lo and behold, Meghan and Harry, they came out of the Book of Kells. They walked over and the girls were going, they're coming, they're coming. And the girls had actually flowers, but they also had these T-shirts that said, when Meghan met Harry.
Ah.
Anyhow, Meghan came along and I was trying to take a photograph of the two girls and Meghan so I'd have it for the girls. And of course, it didn't work. And I said to Meghan, did you see the girls' T-shirts? So that's why she's standing back and
yes.
Looking at it. And she was kind of, you know, saying, oh my God, there's actual T-shirts, you see. And then Harry came and Harry said, where did you get the T-shirts? And the girl said, oh, we got them in Asda. And he says, do they sell them there?
It's a lovely, lovely photograph because everybody in it looks like they're smiley, happy, warm and just glad to be there and glad to be alive. It's
From The Ray D'Arcy Show on Thursday. The contender on Second Captains last Saturday was the multi-award winning novelist Kevin Barry. But despite his obvious success in the world of literature, his big challenge was to make an impact in the Second Captains non-sportsperson, sportsperson contest and to try to topple comedian Aisling B from the top of the leaderboard. Well, he certainly upped the bragging rights when it came to his sporting career.
Well, listen, which sport then, Kevin, got the best out of a young Kevin Barry as a competitor?
I found my métier, as they say, when I started playing pool in a very serious way in the 90s in Cork. Again, without sounding immodest, I would say kind of mid-late 90s in Cork City when I was playing a lot of pool. I was top six. Top six, I would imagine.
Did they publish your top 10 at the Evening Echo?
No, this
week?
Was all going on in my head, but it was there would have been nights as well when the arm was moving where you were probably looking at number one, you know.
Were you a hustler?
Oh, we'd play for money, like, yeah, for sure. But I have great memories of an old pool hall in Cork, the Pot Black, which was on Washington Street. I would have been a daily patron of the Pot Black for a long time. And always you could spot the really serious pool players in the pubs by the bottle of Club Orange alongside him, you know. That's the guy. Don't have
don't
a bet.
Ever play
don't
that
have
guy.
A bet.
Yeah,
well, I would have thought that's a dead giveaway. I would have thought if you're going for the white man can't jump style of hustling, you go in there and you look maybe like you've had a few too many and somebody says, oh, yeah, I'll take you on.
Right, yeah. The great thing about pool is that it's everybody's personality really comes out on the pool table. And I was a really snaky, sneaky pool player. You know? Even if I had simple pots on, I would always snooker the fella if the opportunity presented.
Hang on,
always.
You snookered people playing pool. That's a
cardinal
sin.
Always, yeah. Just to mess with their heads and just to get to two shots and just to make sure, you know.
This is a despicable attitude you're showing.
Oh yeah, definitely a malevolent streak in my character would come out on the pool table. It's sad now I don't play so much or so often. And when I do go back and, you know, play the odd game of pool, it's like Zlatan at LA Galaxy, you know, occasional wonder goal.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Most of the time you're kind of...
It's a pale shadow of the relentless competitor
it
you
goes,
looked in the mirror.
Goes. Yeah.
Novelist Kevin Barry heard on Second Captains with Owen McDevitt and Kieran Murphy. Paula Lambert is best known as the voice of Bosco, a puppet close to my own heart. Well, Paula is back on the road touring the country with the Red-Headed Wonder, but she took time out on Tuesday to talk to Ray Darcy about what it was like growing up as a member of the famed Lambert puppet family and her sadness at the recent decision to close the theatre.
The puppet story starts in Finglas, really.
Does it?
Yeah, it was like the 10 of us were born in Finglas. And when RTE started, my dad worked in RTE. He did a programme called Murphy House of Cordia, which was a marionette show. And that was kind of the first puppet show. But before that, he was a refrigeration engineer, as they used to call it. He used to work in Recalls, fixing fridges. And then he would come home in the evening and he'd change out of his overalls and put on his dress suit and he'd go off and do his vent act at dinners and all these...
Ventriloquism.
So that's in the early days, that's what he was most famous for. His puppet was called Finnegan and he travelled up and down all over the country with Finnegan.
And were your parents Dubs?
No, they were from Sligo. So my mum came from Boyle and daddy came from Sligo town. He was born in Sligo and they met, my mother was a nun. She came from those very hard times in Ireland, which she actually never really talked about. But she was born in Boyle and her mum died of TB, as a lot of parents did in those days. And her dad went off to the war and she was sent to a nunnery. And her two sisters and her little brother were sent to the Nazareth home in Sligo, which was one of these notorious places that none of them ever recovered from. And then mum, she was a divil of a character. And when a nun died in the convent, they got brand new habit and brand new slippers.
To be buried in?
To be buried in.
Right.
And mum saw the new slippers on the dead nun and swapped them with hers that had a big hole in it. And her name was Sister Mary Ambrose. So what she did, she swapped the slippers and she got caught. And then she was put on a fast and she went down to 5 stone. And they sent her back to her family in Sligo to die, basically.
They enforced a fast on, as punishment for taking the slippers from the dead nun.
Yeah. And then she went home to Sligo and kind of she recovered and she met my dad and they ran away together. And then she had 10 kids.
Paula Lambert heard on the Ray Darcy show. Well, there's been oceans of tragedy and grief in John Pender's young life. He was only 13 when his sister Fiona Pender went missing from her home in Tullamore in County Offaly. She was 7.5 months pregnant. That was in August 1996. Since then, both his parents have died and his brother before them. So John has now taken up the search for Fiona and he made a fresh appeal for information when he spoke with Ryan Tuberty.
The tragedy of losing your brother in a motorcycle accident and for your folks to try and get their heads around that, because that's all wrong and that should never happen.
It was a freak accident.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was shocking to us. Yeah,
and then for your sister Fiona to go missing and become part of that awful ghoulish list of people who've gone missing.
Yes,
your mother, amazing woman. What did your mother say?
It was basically, if you've ever lost a child or if you've ever seen a mother that's lost her child in a supermarket, that look of panic on their face, that frantic state of confusion and just wanting to find their child. What she said was to try and leave that supermarket without finding your child, to explain it to people, to what it feels like to have someone missing for such a long time, would be that feeling of having to leave that shop, knowing that your child is gone. You can't explain why. You turned your head for a minute.
That sickening feeling is there forever.
To have to walk away and then try, get back to life or do what you can from afar.
A difficult question, but not too many years afterwards, you describe your dad not being able to cook a meal because grief is that debilitating and it's that destructive on the mind.
It just messed the function up of the house completely. Yeah, it destroyed us. Yeah.
And it was in 2000 you went home. And you found your father.
I just finished work. It was my first job after school in a news agent, and went home just after 6, and I went up the stairs, as was generally do, get changed, and I found my dad, and so I'd never leapt up as quick to try and take his weight. I roared down to my mum to get a knife. She did not know. She had just come in herself from her own job. We rang an ambulance, of course, and I had a chance to give him CPR. The paramedics that came, they let me work on him as a chance to process what had just happened, you know. And pretty quick, I realised that he was there way too long, you know. But as I've said in the documentary, I'd never seen someone like that just looked calm and peaceful and ready to go. He couldn't deal with the loss of his kids. He couldn't manage, you know. It was too much for him. And now that I have a child of my own, I'm seeing what my parents went through in a whole new perspective.
John Pender with Ryan Tubridy on Wednesday. The multi-award-winning actress Ruth Wilson was in Dublin town this week. She's starring alongside Donal Gleeson in The Little Stranger, the latest film from Lenny Abrahamson. Ruth is probably best known as the star of the TV series The Affair with Dominic West, and season 4 is about to kick off, so she was understandably tight-lipped and not wanting to give anything away before Irish audiences have seen it. But when Kay Sheehy caught up with her, she was very excited by a new TV project called Mrs. Wilson, based on a true family story.
Well, this is a family project. It's a family story, my grandmother's story. She wrote a memoir and she left it to us when she died. And it's basically inspired by that. So that was left to us 10 years ago. And since those 10 years, or in those 10 years, we've found out a lot more about her life and about her life with her husband and what he got up to. So my grandfather was a spy in the interwar years. He wrote 27 spy novels and he married 4 women and never got divorced and had kids with all of them. So this is really about her journey of truth, or her journey of finding out the truth about him and how much she was complicit in that lie by living with him for that many years. So it's a really fascinating story and it was a fascinating experience. A profound experience, actually, and a deep privilege to be able to sit in my grandmother's life and story.
And did you ever know her?
Yeah, she died when I was 22, so I knew her pretty well, but I didn't know these things. I didn't know the extent of this story. And she became a bride of Christ, really, by the end. So we didn't know that journey of her story at all. She kept all that from us. So it's fascinating to relive her life through drama. And
did she look like you?
A little bit. I think I look more like the other grandmother, actually. But, I mean, I dress like her in this. I couldn't remember her voice, so it was very hard. The whole thing was quite an unusual experience. But it's coming out at the end of the year, so I'm very proud of it.
Ruth Wilson with Kay Sheehy as heard on Arena. On A Film With Us In It, last Wednesday night, Carol Moran and Owen Sweeney looked once again at the stories behind the films that put Ireland on the movie map. Robbie Canavan of Tuam told them about the time the production of Alfred the Great, starring David Hemmings and Ian McKellen, pitched up at Castle Hacket, Belclare, just outside the town.
But a lot of stories came from the making of this film, some of them very funny. The actors, or we'll call them the civilians stroke actors, were divided into usually students and members of the army or the FCA. I think the Army FCA played the Vikings and the students played the Saxons. Fight scenes, day and night, were very real because a lot of enmity between the FCA stroke Army, who thought those snotty nosed little students wanted a bit of a set to, and the students said, who the feck do those Army guys think they are? So a lot of guys used to return to Tuam the evening with bloody noses and bloody cheekbones. And the attitude was, not that they got the Viking, but they got that bastard in the FCA.
And you can hear the final episode of A Film With Us In It, with Carol and Owen, this coming Wednesday night at 10 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. On Bowman, Sunday 8:30, John Bowman once again trawled the RTE archives to trace the work of composer Brian Boydell to mark the publication of his musical memoir.
My hobby, from about the age of 9 or 10 onwards, was chemistry. And I had my own laboratory at home, and I spent all my pocket money on buying chemicals from Lennox Chemicals and doing experiments and all the rest of it. The result is that I was always ahead of my colleagues at school in chemistry. Got a kick out of that, I suppose. But I was enormously keen on this. And that was a great interest to me, which encouraged my father in thinking, well, here's the man to go in to the family business and overhaul the scientific side of it.
He got his science degree, and his father remained disappointed that his son, who had had his own laboratory from boyhood and obviously had an aptitude for science, was still reluctant to enter the family firm. But his father kept his promise that Brian, if he got his science degree, could then test his interest in music, and he enrolled in the College of Music in London, where Paddy Hadley was his teacher.
Paddy Hadley had a habit of going on the booze every now and then, and when he was incapable of taking his classes, he'd hand you over to Herbert Howells. And I think that resulted in the very best composition lesson I ever had. I've always felt that you can really only teach technique, that if you tell a student too strongly how he should do the thing, he just becomes a clone of the teacher. But I went one week having set a rather romantic poem as a song, and I remember Paddy looked at the thing and he said, "That's a very crawly bass. Let's have some decent manly jumps. Go back and write it again, and let's have a nice bass." And so I rewrote the song and came back next week. Paddy was on the booze, so I was sent to Herbert Howells, and he looked at my song. He says, "That's a very angular bass. You know, it's a romantic song. Let's have some nice drooping semitones here. Nice chromatic writing is what we need here." Totally opposite views from two very respected people. And that's what really convinced me that you've just got to be your own very strong critic.
And you can catch part two of the Brian Boydell story on tomorrow morning's edition of Bowman, Sunday, 8:30. Well, I hope you'll stay tuned for Second Captains. Owen and Murph will be here shortly after the 10 o'clock news. But I'll leave you now with a Kate Rusby song, which I heard on Wednesday night's Arena. Mairead Ní Gonail is on vocals with Martin O'Connor on the box and Seamy O'Dowd on guitar. It's called The Lark. Gurum haga vas for golúder, ta sulam gurwan chiv salt as a glor, agus gamishiv lom taka an amikena an tachtan shahugin. Gijishin, gijishib slán.
Out in the field where the lark it flies, over the earth where my heart it lies. Oh, how it sings when the west winds blow, out in the field where no one goes. Oh, how I'm cold, will you let now and I roam free. Is it wrong to wish you still need me? Is it wrong to wish you still need me? Out in the field where the lark it sings, there I was waiting for all. Stood and there I fell, out in the field that I know well. Oh, how I'm cold, will you let me in? If you could hear me speak, where would I begin? Time it is past, now and I roam free. Is it out in the field where the lark resides, here I remain where my heart can hide. Only the lark and the west winds know past, now and I